All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is episode 52 of the American Vindicta Show. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. Today's date is February 1st, 2022. Now, I have some pretty cool news. Tomorrow, we're going to be interviewing Tim Alberino. I'm sure many of you have heard of him if you've heard of Steve Quell. But if not, Tim Alberino is a brilliant man. He's a real-life George of the Jungle kind of guy. He's a real-life Indiana Jones. And he just has some of the most outrageous stories that you've ever heard of, but also just a very brilliant mind. And we're going to talk about his new book. We're going to talk about his upcoming conference that he'll be hosting in Tennessee, so that's going to be really cool. So stay tuned for that tomorrow. And, you know, we have been on this trail of talking about the Nazi Empire for a while, and I veered off it for a little bit, but I want to get back onto it just a little bit today. But before we get there, let's talk about some sponsors. If you go to my website, www.AmericanVindictaShow.com, go to the sponsors page, and you will find all those who are sponsoring me. Now, one of them that will be populating soon is Mountain State Survival. Now, that's mountain-state-survival.com. And that's Jeff's website. And Jeff's a great guy. He really wants to help out the community. He wants to be able to give back to the community that he is, you know, invested so much in. And I would ask that you, if you are looking for any type of preparatory needs, if you're looking for the food, the survival items, you know, Jeff is he's a small business owner. And I find it very important within the Christian community that we give back to one another and that we support one another. So please check out his website. Show Jeff some love. And, you know, I want to thank Jeff for being a sponsor of the show. It's strange to me to think that I'm just a guy sitting in a spare bedroom in my house yelling into a radio when only a couple months ago I was, you know, part of the federal government. But, you know, that's the twists and turns of life. Things change. You have to learn to adapt and overcome. And that's what we're doing. And, you know, thank you to everyone who has been donating through the PayPal link that's on my website. I cannot believe you crazy people are giving me money to keep doing this. But everything that you're doing is going to sit there. It's going to sit in PayPal. It's going to collect until we can eventually get up to building a studio. So that's what everything for that is going to. The studio is something that is kind of a dream of mine, but I think it's going to be very cool. It'll be a new spin on entertainment for we Christians, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there, but not very much of it is Christian-based. And some of it, you know, I'm not going to lie, is dorky, B-rated, just obnoxious to watch and listen to. And, you know, I'm not a cuddly, feel-good kind of movie guy. I like my thrillers. I like my sci-fi stuff. I like the deep-thinking style scripts. So that's kind of what I'm going to be doing. And I'm going to be producing my own short movie scenes, scripts, clips, whatever the heck they're called. And it's going to be called The Wrecker Chronicles. And you've heard probably on episode 49, we had a theatrical, and that is the teasing the introduction into it. So I have debated on how I would introduce all of this. But the way we're going to do this is it's going to be a little bit of radio entertainment. So for any of you who like audiobooks or, you know, the ebooks out there, consider this to be something like that. But Wrecker is a character that I have been working on. And he is positioned somewhere in the near future, like the 2030s, 40s, after a lot of different stuff has happened. And we're basing this also off of Revelation. So, you know, this is obviously fiction. But what I want to do is I want to turn the different scenarios that a Christian family, man or woman, would be, you know, potentially introduced to during the time of Great Tribulation, during the Mark of the Beast, during the Great World Wars, you know, the Great Famines and the Plagues, you know, during the Pestilence. There's all different types of, you know, really good material there that we can interject somebody into. And it could be a way to say, hey, you know, if you are in this scenario, given this situation, what would you do? And how can we relate that upon the biblical narrative? So that's what I'm working on. I am actually currently writing a script right now for one of the scenes. You know, I'm not a film writer. I'm not an actor. I'm not a movie producer. I'm just a redneck Texan who was, you know, retired from law enforcement. And, you know, I'm just going to give it my best. And you know, I've already purchased some equipment already. I really don't know what I'm going to do with it. I still find that I type my keyboard with, you know, two fingers. So I'm learning as I go. If any of this had to do with shooting guns or, you know, farm stuff, I think I'd be pretty well off, but it doesn't. So this is a learning process for me. But I think it's going to be something really fun. I think it's going to be something really cool. I think you're going to enjoy it. People want to be entertained, but they want to learn. They want to be given that what-if scenario that they can interject themselves into. And, you know, once again, on that biblical narrative, we are going to cross some gray areas that are hard to talk about. We're going to talk about and show you some scenes of things that you may experience that most people have never experienced, have never heard of, and may not know how to properly react. So we're going to give you a bit of a inspiration with this, but you know, it's a cool form of entertainment. No one else is really doing it. And I figure, you know, I want to be different. I don't want to be like every Joe Schmo out there who just, you know, has a podcast and he just talks or sits in front of a computer and just talks. To me, it gets boring. There's some really good guys out there and gals out there that do that. I don't know if I fit that genre. I'm typically a very quiet person, but a very intense person with the things that I do. So, you know, it's going to be intense. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to interject my character into some very intense situations, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Friday, we are going to have the great Bob Griswold on for an interview. That is going to be an entertaining interview. Bob and I have conspired a little bit and talked about this Wrecker Chronicles series, and I let him hear a bit of the script, and man, Bob went off for about 30 minutes about stuff that he would do that I'm not going to share over the radio. And, you know, he thought that it was a good idea, you know, putting Christians into that gray zone where you don't really know what is the right thing to do, what is the wrong thing to do. I'll give you an example. Let's say you're sitting around a fire. You and your family have been on the run. And we're talking about during the time that Christians are being hunted down by other so-called Christians, when it is outlawed to be a follower of Jesus, when your society has collapsed, your military is no longer there to protect you in the way you used to think, and, you know, I guess we could say communism wins the day. But what would you do if there you are, you and your family, maybe a few other groups of families sitting around a fire, and you have the person walk up to your fire out of the dark, And then they say, I want to join your group, but I have the chip in my hand. What do you do, Christian? Do you pull out your Bible immediately, go to what John the Revelator said, and try to look up what the correct answer is? Do you try to reason with that person to gain information? Do you offer the choice of, hey, you know, you took the chip and you denied Christ, so you kind of screwed yourself. You're going to have to leave. Or are you going to also be that same person who says, well, you can't just leave. We can't just let you leave now because you know where we are. So I'm going to put you in that situation. I'm going to make you think. I'm going to make you question a little bit of morality. Don't think, Christians, that when things break bad, when prophecy has hit the fan, that you will not question part of your morality, that you will not, you know, we will all be guided by the Spirit, but do not think you will not be put in a questionable situation, something that's going to make you feel uneasy, you know, and I'm not saying be criminals. I do not agree with that. I don't agree with a lot of the things in the prepper movement that I hear about people, you know, wanting to more or less be marauders and get gunned up and geared up and go out and have this gigantic battle with all their neighbors. Have fun. Have fun. I'm too old to do that now. However, don't think it can't happen. Don't think that that first gunfight can't happen within the first 2 or 3 hours of your bug out, when everyone loses their mind, or 2 weeks later when everyone runs out of food. There are times where we as Christians are going to have to look back into the book of Lamentation, and we're going to have to question just what it is that a nation under judgment could possibly look like. What could it look like when you have no power? What could it look like when you run out of food? Will it eventually get so bad, like in the book of Lamentations, where mothers were eating their children, where cannibalism was common? And by that point, you know, if cannibalism is common, well, you know, I would say avoid that place. But that's what we're going to look at. That's the abject goal of this. The Record Chronicles is going to be a series at least once a week. I don't know what day it's going to be on yet, but it'll be at least once a week. I think you're going to find it to be pretty awesome. The editing takes forever to do. Just that 20 minutes of the intro of the Record Chronicles that you heard on episode 49 took me 6 hours of editing. And I have no idea what I'm doing, but, you know, I pulled it off. So I hope some of you enjoyed it. You know, and I am getting the emails from fans who are telling me what they like about the show, what they would like to see things brought up on the show. And I want you to know that if you email me, I will email you. I'm not one of these guys who, you know, I hold my head up above everybody else. I think I'm, you know, some sort of a celebrity superstar because I have my own show. I think it's ridiculous that people think like that. But, you know, money goes to people's heads. I am not a rich man by any means at all. I made 3 times the amount of money when I worked for the federal government because I was making 6 figures. I made probably 3 times that compared to what I'm doing now. We are scraping by the grace of God. But you know what? I'm happy. I'm happy the chains have been taken off. I'm my own man again, and I'm rediscovering, you know, what it means to be your own man again. And I'm having fun with this. So I'm going to put all my effort into this show, into entertaining you and bringing you good material. We are going to go to our first break. We're going to get into some of the stuff that I have wrote for you. And I think you're going to find it to be very interesting. So hang with me. We'll be right back.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
Okay, welcome back to American Vindicta. During the previous episodes, we have uncovered the rise of the Nazi Empire, the beginning origins prior to the Nazi Party, and the speculations from many historians as to why the regime was even created. We've discussed the rise and fall of the SA, Stormtrooper Brown Shirts, and Hitler's directed assassination against the Brown Shirts High Command and various other members. We've shed light on the infamous Heinrich Himmler and his creation of the Waffen-SS, his role and responsibilities for carrying out the final solution, and the driving force Himmler was for the brutal mass murders and the bizarre occultism, to include Wevelsberg Castle. We went in depth with the SS involvement into how law enforcement in Germany was being used and involved more or less in the targeting of ethnic groups and political groups. But not just that, but there's a collaboration that happened within the SS of how they took various wings of law enforcement and they compiled them all underneath one agency, the SS. Much like, I don't want to say it, but Department of Homeland Security. They took all these different agencies and they compiled them all underneath one. Now, in DHS's namesake, the whole portion of that was so that all of our agencies could talk to each other. We could have some sort of a method of understanding, but that never happened. So, that was a failed experiment. But it did happen with the Nazis. It absolutely did. The police under Nazi Germany is something to honestly, I would say, to be very, very wary of. If we ever go the route of compiling organizations together underneath a political leader, it is time to revolt. I fear whenever I hear Democrats say they want to do X, Y, and Z with law enforcement, or any Republican with that, it's a very slippery slope. It's one of those things that, much like the Second Amendment, law enforcement needs to be left alone. It needs to be completely disengaged from politics. And I think, honestly, there should be some sort of a, I would love to see someone sue the Department of Justice and the Democratic Party for using the FBI and the ATF and IRS and the DEA and how they have weaponized these agencies and they use them against other political entities. Be it right or left or right doing it, it's wrong and it shouldn't happen. So I would love to eventually to see somebody take up the mantle and sue these agencies, sue the Department of Justice and the politicians. But honestly, I think it would fall upon deaf ears. I think it would fall upon deaf ears and you would be ignored. The courts would probably say you wouldn't have a case, you know, even though the evidence is right there in front of them with January 6th, with all these other debacles that have happened, it would probably still be denied. So, you know, when it comes to the SS and the targeting of by law enforcement, we also have to talk about how it was used for the detainment of citizens and the expulsion of these groups of citizens from their homes to ghettos, and from ghettos to then concentration camps that were also manned by various law enforcement organizations from multiple different countries, and also the SS. Now, those who helped with the incarceration of the prisoners, various were obviously other policing agencies deployed by the SS in other countries, but the German Wehrmacht, the German military, the German Order Police, and of course the SS were all involved in it. The SS would eventually oversee most of the concentration camps and extermination camps during the late 1930s to 45. And overall, an estimated 6 million Jews would die in the concentration and extermination camps. Between 250,000 and 300,000 Jews withstood the concentration camps and the death marches. Although tens of thousands of these brave survivors would still perish due to illness or overall weakness from starvation, tens of thousands would still die a few days or a few weeks or a few months after their liberation, despite intense medical care given to them by the Allies. As the Nazi war machine would envelop Europe and parts of Russia, we learned that over 50 to 60 million deaths occurred in World War II, to include military and civilian fatalities. Additionally, 19 to 28 million deaths were related to disease and famine. Civilian deaths in World War II estimated to be between 50 and 55 million souls. From 1941 to 1945, the U.S. lost approximately 416,800 service members in combat. The Soviet Union had by far the most casualties, but both civilian and military to include, its estimations are that Russia lost 10,700,000 soldiers in World War II, along with 14 million civilians. A census that was done in 1939 showed Russia to have a population of 110 million. So this would mean that Russia would have lost over 15% of its population in just 3 years due to the Nazis. Now, due to Operation Barbarossa, which the original name was Operation Fritz, during World War II, the code name for the German invasion of the Soviet Union, which was launched on June 22nd, 1941, the failure of German troops to defeat Soviet forces in the campaign signaled a crucial turning point in the war. Now, although Adolf Hitler had congratulated himself on the German Soviet non-aggression pact of 1939 as a some matter of expediency and anti-Bolshevism, the anti-Bolshevism had remained his most profound emotional conviction as World War II entered its second year. Now, Following the Soviet occupation of the Baltic states and of Bessarabia and northern Bukovina in June 1940, which had put Soviet forces in a proximity to the Romanian oil fields on which Germany depended, Hitler's longstanding interest in overthrowing the Soviet regime was heightened. Does any of that sound familiar to Saddam Hussein? History rhymes every now and then. Hitler became acutely suspicious of the intentions of the Soviet leader, Joseph Stalin, and he began to feel that he could not afford to wait to complete the subjugation of Western Europe. You know, if you recall, Hitler, while he was taking on Eastern Europe, he had this dream of the German people expanding westward, like the Germanic tribes that were in the early years of Germany, and he wanted to re-fulfill that dream. So the only people who were in his way were the Russians and the Czechoslovakians. And that was what Operation Barbarossa was all about. It is an atrocity when you look up some of the videos of Operation Barbarossa and all the other stuff that you see. The SS killed indiscriminately. They killed, I think it's like up to 30,000 prisoners of war. And they just shot them. Just shot them. And they complained that they were running out of bullets. War does strange things to people. It really does. It puts you in a different perspective. And I feel that it is a need of mine to explain to you the barbarity of people, even in modern day. Because it can happen again. I don't know. All right. I'm going to get off my soapbox. Hitler had originally planned, before dealing with the Soviet Union, to eventually invade westward. Hitler and his generals had originally scheduled the invasion of the USSR for mid-May 1941. But due to unforeseen necessity of invading Yugoslavia and Greece in April of that year, that forced them to postpone the Soviet campaign to late June. The swiftness of Hitler's Balkan victories enabled him to keep to this revised timetable. But the 5 weeks delay shortened the time for carrying out the invasion of Soviet Russia and was to prove the more serious matter because in 1941, the Russian winter would arrive earlier than usual. And nevertheless, Hitler and the heads of the Oberkommando der Heeres, which is the German Army High Command, namely the Army Commander-in-Chief, Walther von Brauchitz, and the Army General Staff Chief, which was Franz Halder, were convinced that the Red Army could be defeated in 2 or 3 months and that by the end of October, the Germans would have conquered the whole European part of Russia and Ukraine, west of a line stretching of Archangel to Astrakhan. Now, the invasion of the Soviet Union was originally given the code name Operation Fritz. But as preparations began, Hitler renamed it Operation Barbarossa, after the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, who reigned in 1152 to 1190, and who also sought German predominance throughout Europe. Now, for the campaign against the Soviet Union, the Germans allotted almost 150 divisions, containing about 3 million men. Among those units were 19 panzer divisions of the SS. And in total, the Barbarossa force had about 3,000 tanks, 7,000 pieces of artillery, and 2,500 aircraft. It was, in effect, the largest and most powerful invasion force in human history. That's why we're really talking about this, the feat of this attack. Now, the German strength was further increased by more than 30 divisions also of Finnish and Romanian troops who were allies of Nazi Germany for that time. The Soviet Union had twice or perhaps three times the number of both tanks and aircraft as the Germans had. But, and I do mean but, their aircraft were mostly obsolete compared to the Nazis. The Soviet tanks were about equal to those of the Germans, however. A greater hindrance to Hitler's chances of victory was that the German intelligence service underestimated the troop reserves that Stalin could bring up from the depths of the Soviet Union. The Germans correctly estimated that there were about 150 divisions in the western parts of the Soviet Union and reckoned that 50 more might be able to be produced. But the Soviets actually brought up more than 200 fresh divisions by the middle of August, making a total of 360 divisions, millions of Soviets. The consequence was that, though the Germans succeeded in shattering the original Soviet armies by superior technique, they found that their path was blocked by fresh ones. The effects of the miscalculations were increased because much of August was wasted while Hitler and his advisors were having long arguments as to what course they should follow after their initial victories. Another factor in the Germans' miscalculations was purely political, though no less mistaken, that they believed that within 3 to 6 months of their invasion, the Soviet Union would collapse from the lack of domestic support. On June 22, 1941, the German offensive was launched by three army groups under the same commanders as in the invasion of France in 1940. On the left, which will be the northern side, you had an army group under General Wilhelm von Lieb, who struck from East Prussia into the Baltic states toward Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. On the right side, which is the southern side, you had an army group under General Gerd von Runditz, I cannot pronounce these names, I apologize, with an armored group under General Paul Ludwig von Kleist. And they advanced from southern Poland into Ukraine against Kyiv, whence it was to wheel southeastward to the coast of the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. Last in the center, which is north of the Pripyat Marshes, the main blow was delivered by General Fedor von Bock's army group, with one armored group under General Heinz Guderian, and also another general under Hermann Hoth, who was thrusting northeastward into Smolensk and Moscow. The invasion along a 1,800-mile front, 1,800 miles worth of this invasion front, took the Soviet leadership completely by surprise and caught the Red Army in an unprepared and partially demobilized state. As part of the southern flank of Bock's group and Guderian's tanks raced 50 miles beyond the frontier on the first day of the invasion and were finally in Minsk, which is about 200 miles beyond it, which was June 27th, Minsk converged with Hoth's tanks, which had attacked from the northern flank, so they're doing kind of a pincer-like movement. But Bock's infantry could not follow up quickly enough to complete the encirclement of the Soviet troops in the area. Though 300,000 prisoners were taken in the salient, a large part of the Soviet forces was able to escape to the east. The Soviet armies were clumsily handled and frittered their tank strength away in a piecemeal action like that of the French in 1940. But the isolated Soviet troops fought with a stubbornness that the French had just not shown, and their resistance imposed a break by continuing to block road centers long after the German tide had swept past them. The result was similar when Guderian's tanks, having crossed the Dnieper River on July 10th, entered Smolensk, which was 6 days later, and they had converged with General Haas' tanks, which was the thrust through Vitebsk. Now, 200,000 Soviet prisoners were taken. But some Soviet forces were withdrawn from the trap to the line of the Desna River, and a large pocket of resistance lay behind the German armor. By mid-July, moreover, a series of rainstorms were turning the sandy Russian roads into clogging mud, over which the wheeled vehicles of the German transport behind the tanks could make only very slow progress. The German also began to be hampered by the scorched earth policy adopted by the retreating Soviets. The Soviet troops burned crops, they destroyed bridges, and evacuated factories in the face of the German advance. Entire steel and munitions plants in the westernmost portions of the Soviet Union were dismantled and shipped by railroad to the east, where they were put back into production. How ingenious is that? The Soviets, they also destroyed or evacuated most of their rolling stock, their railroad cars, thus depriving the Germans of the use of the Soviet rail system. And since Soviet railroad trucks, railroad track was of a gauge different from the German track and German rolling stock, it was, you know, consequently useless on it. And if you remember, a lot of the mobile artillery was used by the Germans, the big siege howitzers, they were used by the railroads. So they could not effectively, at that point, move the large howitzers into Russian railroads. They weren't the same configuration, so really that's quite a stroke of luck at that point. Nevertheless, by mid-July, the Germans had advanced more than 400 miles and were only 200 miles away from Moscow. They still had ample time to make decisive gains before the onset of winter, but they lost the opportunity, primarily because of arguments throughout August between Hitler and the German Army High Command about the destination of the next series of attacks. Whereas the German High Command proposed Moscow as the main objective, Hitler wanted to he wanted the major effort to be directed southeastward through Ukraine and the Donets Basin into the Caucasus Mountains, with a minor swing northwestward against Leningrad to converge with General Lieb's army group. In Ukraine, meanwhile, General Runst and Kleist had been made short work of the foremost Soviet defenses, and stronger, though, than the latter had been. A new Soviet front in the south of Kyiv was broken by the end of July, and in the next fortnight, the Germans swept down to the Black Sea into the mouths of the Bug and Dnieper rivers to converge with Romania's simultaneous offensive. Kleist was then ordered to wheel northward from central Ukraine and Guderian southward from the Smolensk for a pincer movement around the Soviet forces behind Kyiv. By the end of September, the claws of the encircling movement had caught 520,000 men off guard. These gigantic encirclements were partially the fault of inept Soviet high commanders and partially the fault of Joseph Stalin, who was commander-in-chief stubbornly, who would override the advice of his generals and ordered his armies to stand and fight instead of allowing them to retreat eastward and regroup in preparation for a counteroffensive. As winter approached, Hitler stopped General Lieb's northward drive on the outskirts of Leningrad. He ordered General Runz and Kleitz, however, to press on from the Dnieper River toward the Don and the Caucasus. General Bock, meanwhile, was to resume the advance on Moscow. Bock's renewed advance began on October 2, 1941. Its prospects looked bright when Bock's armies brought off a great encirclement around Vyazma, where 600,000 more Soviet troops were captured. That left the Germans momentarily with an almost clear path to Moscow. But the Vyazma battle was not completed until late in October. The German troops were tired. The country became a morass in the weather as it got worse, and fresh Soviet forces appeared in the Germans' path as they plodded slowly forward. Some of the German generals wanted to break off the offensive and to take up a suitable winter line, which was probably the smartest thing to have done. But General Bock wanted to press forward, believing that the Soviets were on the verge of a collapse, while General Brauchitz and Hodler tended to agree with this view, as that also accorded with Hitler's desire. It agreed with Hitler's desire. They made no objection to it. And the temptation of Moscow, now so close in front of their eyes, was too great for any of the topmost leaders to resist at that point. On December 2nd, a further effort was launched and some German detachments penetrated into the suburbs of Moscow. However, the advance as a whole was held up in the forest covering the capital. The stemming of this last phase of the Great German Offensive was partially due to the effects of the Russian winter, the sub-zero temperatures of which were the most severe in several decades. In October and November, a wave of frostbite cases had decimated the ill-clad German troops, from whom provisions of winter clothing had not been made, while the icy cold paralyzed the Germans' mechanized transports like their tanks and their artillery and their aircraft. The Soviets, by contrast, were well clad and tended to fight more effectively in winter than did the Germans. By this time, German casualties had mounted to levels that were unheard of in the campaigns against France and the Balkans. By November, the Germans had suffered almost 730,000 casualties. In the south, General Kleist had already reached Rostov-on-Don, which is a gateway to the Caucasus, and on November 22nd, he had exhausted his tank's fuel in doing so. So Runitz, seeing the place to be untenable, wanted to evacuate, but it was overruled by Hitler. Now, a Soviet counteroffensive captured Rostov, and on November 28th, General Runz was relieved of his command 4 days later. As the Germans' drive against Moscow slackened, the Soviet commander on the Moscow front on December 6 inaugurated the first great counteroffensive with strokes against Bock's right and the Aletz and Tula sectors south of Moscow and against his center in the Klin and Kalinin, now the Tver sectors, in the northwest. Levies of Siberian troops who were extremely effective fighters in cold weather were used for these offenses. There followed a blow at the German left in the Luki sector, and the counteroffensive, which soon took the form of a triple convergence towards Smolensk, was sustained throughout the winter of 1941 and 42. Operation Barbarossa had begun to miscarry by August 1941. And its failure was a patent when the Soviet counteroffensive started. Although the Red Army experienced greater losses than the Germans during the campaign, the inability of the German forces to defeat the Soviet Union marked a significant setback for the German military effort. I think one of the craziest things when you go to read about Operation Barbarossa is that when these armies were maneuvering, they were capturing not, 10, 20, 15 troops, not hundreds or, 1,000. They were capturing 600,000 men. 200,000 men. Just imagine 200,000 soldiers being captured. I mean, the sheer amount of fighting that had to happen, the amount of bloodshed, the amount of, we know for a fact the bombs that were dropped were just relentless for at least a year straight. Germany ended up losing 730,000 soldiers, and it was also one of the largest losses of the SS. And after the defeat of Barbarossa, Himmler was, scorned by Hitler. He made himself look very inept, very juvenile in his forms of being a military strategic leader, which of he was not. And that's when the thought began in Himmler's mind to start to betray Adolf Hitler. And that's whenever he found that with Operation Barbarossa, at that point, there was no real winning of this war. And it's strange because for about a year or two, they thought they could take over the world. And then because Hitler was mentally unstable and just could not control his urges and pushing his men eastward into Russia, he literally ruined their entire campaign. What would have happened if Hitler would have not broke the treaty with Joseph Stalin? Would we be looking at a different Europe? Would the boundary lines of countries be different right now? I think it would be. Honestly, I do. I think when you go back in history and you look at the evidence and you look at the machines of war and the technology and the persistence of the German, you see a reluctance to give up and a reluctance to, understanding. There was no parlay with them. There was no coming to terms with them by the time the war machine was turned on you. Germany just would not stop until it was utter annihilation or just complete conquer. And, it was because of during that time, Hitler started to slowly lose his mind, that thankfully Operation Barbarossa went awry. Thankfully the Red Army stood in the face of evil and, socked it to them. And that's why whenever we eventually, invaded and collapsed into Berlin, into the Eagle's Nest, where Hitler's palace was. When the Russian soldiers were coming in, now that's a part of history that not many people talk about, because they did some horrendous things. They burned and pillaged their entire way into Berlin, and I don't want to say rightly so. But what could you expect? The Nazis indiscriminately killed over 30,000 just prisoners, who were all civilians, by the way. For the most part, they were Russian Jews. And, It's what you come to expect when you have a satanic occult-like army that believes they can take over the world, and whenever they start to lose face, when they start to lose territory and ground, and they see they're going to be defeated, scorched earth policy, they destroy everything as they were leaving, which is what they did. They did the same thing the Russians did as they were evacuating from the area. But it was just another kind of level of evil that the Nazis did. And I would strongly suggest do your own research, educate yourself on it. History's it's never a bad time to relearn history or to learn of history. I think we are on the verge of repeating history if we don't back off with Russia right now. And I just, for the life of me, I don't know what in the hell our president is thinking, even though I know sock puppet Joe Biden is not thinking. This man is going to get us into a war. These Democrats are going to get us into a war that we cannot back out of, that we cannot back down from. And just look at the freedom rallies. Look at the trucker rallies that are happening right now. You know, there's obviously something going on that would show you that, you know, people are fed up. They don't believe in the lies. They don't believe in the Black Lives Matter lies anymore. I mean, just listen to this. Black Lives Matter spent $6.3 million buying a mansion in Toronto. The purchase of the former headquarters of the Canadian Communist Party was made through Janaya Khan, the wife of the BLM co-founder Patrice Cullors, who herself spent millions on multiple homes. So I'm guessing it's a lesbian couple, whatever. Here's some other here's some interesting things. Little bit of the past here, not too far in the past. I'm sure some of you remember what happened in Seattle with the unconstitutional autonomous zone called CHAZ. Well, shocking newly released memos, first hinted through a deposition in a lawsuit by victims of Seattle's autonomous zone, shows that the administration of former Mayor Jenny Durkin actually drafted documents to transfer the ownership of the evacuated police Eastern Precinct to the local Black Lives Matter group, the property of which is worth millions. You can read that on the Post Millennial. That's an update from Andy No. This world has gone absolutely crazy. I mean, every day I look at the news and I am reminded as to why I hate looking into the news. Dinesh D'Souza, I don't know if you're a fan of him or not. I kind of am at times. But he's got a new movie trailer out called 2,000 Mules, exposing ballot traffickers who stole the 2020 election. And he has video footage that they were able to obtain from ballot boxes in key states across America where the ballots were contested. So how about that, huh? Yeah, how about them apples? Who would have ever thought that the Democrats would cheat at elections? You know, real quick before we go, I want you to consider that this year is an election year for Congress. This is a very important time for the Democrats. They more or less know they're going to lose office. Many of them know that their constituents are pissed off and hate their guts, and that they're going to lose power. Let me ask you a question. What do you think these people would be willing to do or not do in order to maintain power? Would they be willing to put us into a world war? Would they be willing to start a war with Russia? Would they be willing to have a new variant of a virus come out from Dr. Fauci's Frankenstein labs? I wouldn't put anything past them. Honestly, I wouldn't. I wouldn't put anything past them. But then again, there's snakes. And no matter how much these people try to shed their skins, they're still snakes. I don't trust them. I don't like them. They're not out for the good of humanity or for me and you. And I honestly believe that these people will do anything they can to stay in power. So because of that, stay prepared. Stay prepped. Stay mentally ready, spiritually ready. Visit Bob Griswold, ready-made resources. Please visit Bob Griswold's website. We forgot to do his plug. You can actually just call Bob Griswold and talk to him about preparedness, and that man will talk to you for free, when a lot of people will charge you hundreds of dollars just for about an hour of consultation. So give Bob a call. If you want night vision, give Bob a call. I'm telling you right now, there's no reason why if you have the ability to buy night vision right now, I'd be doing it. I damn sure would be doing it. And I would be prepping my guns, buying my bullets, the beans, bullets, band-aids, saving up gas, you know, storing gas, making sure my car is in good working condition, making sure all my preps are in good order. And for everyone right now in the Northeast affected by the bomb cyclone, my thoughts and prayers are with you. I hope that you and your family stay safe. It's going to continue to get rough, but we're going to make it through this. God is on our side. And if God is on our side, who can stand against us? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Doug Thornton. This is American Vindicta. Out.
All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.